Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How might some of Africa's most troubled countries be different if their citizens were permanently protected from malaria? Malaria sickens 500 million people every year and kills 1 million, even though scientists understand how it spreads and how it can be prevented. Decades of effort by both governments and non-governmental aid organizations have failed to loosen malaria's stranglehold on the continent. But as my guest today will explain, a program initiated 5 years ago by a self-made American millionaire is making impressive strides in targeted places, in part by applying business logic and business strategies to eradication efforts. Journalist Alex Perry is chief of Time Magazine's Africa Bureau. His new book is called Lifeblood: How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. Alex, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris.
You start the book with an absolutely terrifying account of your first visit to a place called Apak in Uganda, which you report is the most malarious city on Earth. Can you tell us about what you found there?
Yeah, as you say, it was, I went there because I knew it was the most malarious place on Earth. There'd been a study done 3 or 4 years before showing that the average person in this place, Apak, was bitten nearly 1,600 times a year by a malaria-infected mosquito. So that basically means you're getting malaria 4 times a day. Absolutely unimaginable. And for that reason, because it was unimaginable, I kind of had to go. And I hired a car from Kampala and drove north. And you're driving into the Great Lakes area, which is... Which sounds quite nice, actually, but with this particular Lake Kariba, it's very shallow. It never really gets above kind of head height. And so what we're talking about here is a giant swamp and the perfect breeding ground for a billion mosquitoes, essentially. I drive into this town at about, I suppose, 2 or 3 in the afternoon. There's nobody on the street except for this naked man that stumbles out of a sort of side street, doesn't seem to see me, is sort of mumbling. He's very thin. It's slightly shocking to see. It's also slightly shocking to see that he's stumbling around kind of naked and there's no one else around. And I drive around here and I'm watching him, my rearview mirror, and I see another guy, exactly the same, naked, kind of dirty, dusty, twigs in his hair, looks as though he's been sleeping rough. Again, doesn't really seem to see me. And then, you know, I turn a corner and I see a third guy kind of sitting naked with his head in his hands, just kind of groaning by the side of the street. It really was very weird. It felt, you know, as though I'd arrived somewhere after an apocalypse or something. And, as I say in the book, I decided to stay in my car to see, you know, to try and figure out what was going on. And I drove around. I didn't see anybody else. Eventually, I found myself outside a place whose signboard said it was the district headquarters. Again, nobody around. I just kind of pushed an open door, wandered in, wandered down a corridor, and found a name on a door that said it was the district health officer, and knocked on the door. There was somebody there. And that turned out to be a man called Dr. Amer, Matthew Amer, who's the district health officer for Apak area. And he explained to me what was going on. He said, look, nobody ever goes outside during the daytime or at all if they can help it. You know, that's lethal. You know, the only people who ever go outside are the insane or people who had cerebral malaria as kids, and that's what you saw, people who had, you know, malaria so badly as kids that they had brain damage and they just kind of wander around. And the only other people that go outside are people like yourself who don't know what's going on, and, you know, probably from outside the area. But nobody stepped outside. It was a town that lived indoors. I mean, he was behind two sets of screens and sitting underneath a fan. And he would skip to his car and drive home and then, you know, get back inside. It was a ghost town. There was nothing going on. And because malaria's effect was so oppressive, it had killed everything. I mean, there was no economy. What there was it, you know, the entire town was built around the effect of malaria. The only things that were operating were some dispensaries and some funeral parlors. That was it.
And as sincerely as hospital workers in Apache wanted to help the sick, the poverty there left them with essentially no resources to make any kind of difference.
Right. They had nothing. I mean, in the hospital, there weren't even bed nets on the beds, which is the most basic and one of the cheapest forms of treatment. For fever, for treating a malaria fever, they had headache pills. They had sugar solution. And they had chloroquine, which is used to be a very effective malaria medicine, but it was phased out in most places around the world about 10 years ago because malaria these days is chloroquine resistant. Hmm. And you know, the natural selection has meant that the malaria parasite has evolved. So basically, they had sugar solution, headache pills, and out-of-date medicine. They had nothing.
Malaria takes a particularly rough toll on children. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, malaria is something that you can develop an immunity to, and you do over time. But you do not have it naturally, that immunity, when you're born. And so you're particularly vulnerable as a newborn and up until the age of about five, when if you're living somewhere near the equator in Africa, you've probably had a bout or two, and you've built up some antibodies. The other group, of course, that are particularly vulnerable to malaria are pregnant women, whose immunity drops away, so that they don't pass on these adult strength antibodies to the unborn fetus. But yes, that means that malaria is a killer of children, particularly and pregnant women. And the hospital in Apache was just full of children and pregnant women.
And so there's this horrible cycle of illness and poverty and illness and poverty. Parents have more children than they might normally, knowing that some of them won't survive. They lose a lot of time at work caring for these sick children, and the children don't get a really good education because they're out of school a lot being sick.
Right. I mean, this is one of the sort of one of the things I really learned about malaria, and one of the sort of key themes of the book. That malaria isn't just about the health cost that it has. It's also about the economic cost. It's for a family that's earning, say, you know, a few hundred dollars a year, the cost of treatment if one of your kids get malaria, let alone if all of your kids get malaria several times, is so prohibitive that it's basically cannot be met. So that means that you go through this excruciating decision where you sometimes almost have to select which of your children are going to die, or you get to a point where you simply run out of money and the next kid that gets sick is going to die.
Hmm.
That probably means you have more children than you planned on, because you kind of calculate that a few of them will not make it. It also means that you never progress developmentally, in terms of what dreams and aspirations you might have had in terms of doing well for yourself and your family, perhaps sending them to school, because you spend all your money on medicine and treatment. And even when you run out of money, you take time off work to stay at home to look after your sick kids, and your kids don't go to school because A, you can't afford it, and B, because they're sick. And so there's this horrible downward cycle where malaria tends to exist in poor areas. You know, malaria lives on poverty, where people don't have access to all the money to treatment. But malaria also produces poverty because it traps people in a kind of poverty trap from which they basically can never escape without some outside help.
Yeah, reading the book, I kept getting the image of trying to walk the wrong direction on an escalator, trying to walk up, and the escalator's moving down the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. That's it. But that's a very good image, and it's a good image because it gives you an insight into, you know, how you might begin to address this. And if you're walking up an escalator the wrong, you know, what do? You try and reverse the escalator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you try and. And you do that, and the key insight of the malaria campaign and Ray Chambers, the U.S. special envoy who runs it, is focusing on that, on the economics. You know, that allows you to appeal to a bunch of players who wouldn't normally be interested in this? If you say to ExxonMobil, the biggest company in the world and one of the biggest in Africa, hey, you know, why don't you do some good for the children of Africa? That's not going to fly with their stockholders. If you say to them, do you know what, if you protect the 2,000 people working at your oil rig in Ghana or in Nigeria from malaria, you'll have a workforce that's a lot more productive, a lot more efficient, and you'll make a lot more money, then that has an immediate appeal.
Suddenly it's worth the effort.
You know, in the same way, if you say to an African government, hey, why don't you look after your kids? You know, African health ministers are going to feel a bit patronized. They're going to feel a bit like, you know, here comes a Westerner telling me in a suit, telling me what to do again. If you say to an African government, do you know what? If you handle malaria, your country will be $10 billion a year richer. And this might be, you know, breaking the chains that finally allow you to lift off and race towards prosperity and development, then, again, that has an appeal. That has a much wider appeal. You appeal, essentially, to people's self-interest. And that's the great insight, and that's the secret behind the success of the malaria campaign.
Yeah, that was a really interesting insight for me, Alex, that there are a lot of powerful Africans and African governments that have begun to resent Western aid in some ways, often because it's not that effective to begin with, but they are delighted by investment from outside of the region.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is, investment treats you as an adult. It says, you've got something to offer me, and I want to put money into it. Aid, inevitably, you know, although for the person giving it feels great, brilliant, you know, charity, how much better could that be? But for those receiving, you know, people forget those, you know, the givers forget that for those receiving, charity can be humiliating. Mm-hmm. It can be disempowering. It can be belittling. It's basically saying, you can't take care of yourself, I'm going to do it. Now, you know, there is a new generation. I mean, for a long time, there's been African governments who've been very good at riding that aid gravy train. They've set themselves up as aid recipients, and they have seen the donor community essentially as their constituency. You know, those are the people they've dealt with. Those are the people they felt responsible to and accountable to, you know, at the expense of their own people. And that's not produced good results for Africa. There is a new generation of African leaders now who take their responsibilities to their countries a lot more seriously, who put the interests of their people above all else. And as you say, resent the idea that, say, someone with a fancy degree from a Western university but who is only 25 years old can come in and tell them how to run their country. You know, this is what you should be doing on health. This is how you should run an economy, you know. And with good reason, because aid does not have a good record in Africa. You know, it's been a phenomenal waste of money. There have been huge successes, but there have been, you know, for the amount of money that's gone into Africa, you've got to look at it and say, you know, where's the return in a place like Congo? You know, Congo sucks up hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and it's worse than it's ever been. It has a UN operation there that costs $1 billion a year that has done nothing. I mean, you know, so those sorts of concerns are animating a new level of resentment of aid and resistance to aid and a new mood of self-reliance.
Alex Perry is my guest this hour. He's Africa Bureau Chief for Time Magazine and author of the new book, Lifeblood, How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. Join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alex Perry. He's Africa Bureau Chief for Time Magazine and author of the new book Lifeblood, How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk, Alex, about Ray Chambers, who is now malaria special envoy to the United Nations. But he's an American who grew up poor, worked his way through college playing in a cover band. By his mid-40s, he had hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank. First of all, how did he earn his fortune?
So Ray started off fairly conventionally. He initially worked for an accountancy firm. He comes from Newark, New Jersey. He was the son of a warehouse manager, as you say, paid his way through college. Wasn't rich, but you know, one of those guys with large ambitions. after the stint at the accountancy firm, I think he was a guy that was always going to be his own boss. He bought his way into, I think, with his savings and with money borrowed, into a healthcare firm. This is in the late 60s, early 70s. Which he then sold about 6 or 7 years later, and that was his first million. And that sort of, I think, gave him his insight into what he was going to spend the next 10 or 15 years doing, was buying his way into firms and selling them for a profit and taking the money for himself. That, in particular, what he kind of invented, really, what he pioneered was what became known as the leverage buyout, where you don't put up any money yourself, you borrow the bulk of it, you bet on the fact that you can turn the company around, or that for whatever other reason, a rising stock market, say, the company's shares will rise, and you profit from the rise. You buy in the stock low and you sell it high. And if you leverage to the hilt, this can make, and the prices go up as you expect, this can bring you extraordinary returns. In 1982, Ray and two other partners put up personal stakes of $250,000 each to buy Gibson's greeting card.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the exact amount. But the point is, 14 months later, or 18 months later, when they sold out, they pocketed each $70 million. So from a stake of $250,000, they made over 200%. He did the same thing again with Avis. That he bought for $1 billion, and he sold it 14 months later for $1.75 billion. I mean, you know, it's you keep the difference. I mean, you pay back what you've borrowed, you pay a little bit of interest on it. But it's pure capitalism in its most extreme form. You are not adding anything to the economy here. You're not creating a single job. You are just treating companies as though they're chips on a gambling board, and you're gambling. And if you're Ray, you're winning. Extraordinary amounts. I mean, by the time he was in his mid-40s, he was well on his way to becoming a billionaire. I'm not sure he ever became one, because he sort of had an epiphany. After, you know, several hundred million dollars were in the bank, he suddenly realized that money didn't make him happy, which is slightly awkward if you spent your time accumulating that much, which I think was a quandary for a while. And he began wondering how he might fulfill himself. But being Ray, and being, he's a fairly purposeful man. He did a fair amount of self introspection, and I think almost instinctively he found himself kind of hanging out in a depressed area of Newark, at kind of homeless shelters and initiatives for underprivileged kids and so on. And his first sort of foray into charity work, into helping people, was he adopted 1,000 of those kids and said to them that he would pay their way through college if they kind of stood the course. And from then on, he discovered that helping people like that absolutely delighted him. And he put all his assets into trust and became a philanthropist full-time, initially concentrating on Newark, where he did an extraordinary amount to put that rather depressed city back on its feet again with arts centers and even the first cinema. He brought a big sports team to Newark. There was a lot that he did, so much so that he kind of got noticed by the then president, George Bush, who asked him to head up a thing called the Points of Light Foundation, which is a sort of mentoring program, which I believe has now got so big that I think 5 million people have been inside that mentoring program. It's a phenomenal success. But the interesting thing about what Ray did in Newark was the transformation of a man from pure red in tooth and claw capitalist into a great civic citizen is interesting enough. But the other thing is that he did not dispense with business method in his charity world. When he set up his foundation, he ran it like a business. When he came to any kind of social issue, he broke it down into fundraising, marketing, returns on investment, deadlines, that kind of thing. He set up a non-profit commodities trading firm that would raise money. He would plow his contacts for donors in the same way that he would for investments for a business project. He used exactly the same kind of techniques, and particularly leverage. He put together a kind of triangle model in Newark of how to make three different entities spark off each other to create a bigger whole. So you put together political leadership and cash and the media. And the way it works is basically you say, okay, I'm going to use my cash to make sure we get a dynamic, responsible, forward-looking political leadership. And then you go to business and you say, no, I've done that. Now you, business, are going to invest with me in projects to revitalize this area. And they will work and they will bring returns, because the political leadership is in place to ensure that they get the kind of the background and the backing that they need. You will, as your reward, get as much publicity as you want. Hmm. And that's the third point. Ray then invites in the media who begin to write profiles about the new dynamic business political leadership in Newark that are revitalizing the city, which is rather brilliant.
Everybody wins.
On one stage, it's the businessman and the political leadership get some kind of egotistical reward. They get thanked in public. They get written up as heroes. But it also commits them. They're now in public, in the press, committed to revitalizing Newark. So they can't really back away from it. And this is it's that sort of triangle of three institutions and putting them together that he kind of invented in Newark. It's what exactly he did in the malaria world, and to the stage where he took the most powerful political office on earth, the U.S. president, the biggest company, ExxonMobil, and the biggest media show, the biggest TV show, American Idol, and put those three things together in a malaria campaign. And the result was a campaign that went from a few $10 million at the turn of the millennium to, by 2008, 2009, a campaign that was pushing $3 billion a year.
Hmm. How you know, you hear the story of how he made his money and how he turned his life around to really commit to philanthropic work, and you say, well, good for Ray Chambers and good for Newark. How did his attention focus on a problem half a world away that he had no direct experience with before?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, he was very much a Newark boy and was very focused on that for more than a decade. But I think, like a lot of people around the world, for Ray Chambers, the world changed on 9/11. And for him, I think it was an awakening into the idea that there was a level of resentment, violent resentment around the world at Western economic superiority and Western domination of politics and culture that was quite similar to the kind of resentment that he'd seen on the streets of Newark. But this was, again, this was about inequality. This was about feeling marginalized, feeling excluded, feeling left out, feeling as though you were being pushed around. And for a small minority, that resulted in kind of vengeful, violent terrorism. You know, so the ultimate fix to this problem, once you've hunted down your immediate enemy, is to kind of level the playing field, is to soothe that anxiety and that sense of exclusion, and to level out the, frankly, yawning differences between, you know, the life of someone who's brought up in Manhattan and the life of someone who's brought up in Kampala, and at least sort of give the impression that that there are opportunities for all, that there are ways out here, that you are not trapped in poverty. And the more that he looked into poverty in the developing world, the more the issue of malaria came up, because, as you said in your introduction, this is a disease that we've known how to fix for a century. This is a disease that we've known how to treat for several centuries. You know, this is easy. There's no science here, really. You know, even now, it's mostly about bed nets. You know, we've had bed nets for hundreds of years. So this is, as Ray would say, low-hanging fruit. This becomes a business problem. This is a logistics problem. This is about literally distributing enough bed nets around the world, and you fix a problem. There have been studies done which strongly suggest, or which basically prove, that if you carpet a village, say in Africa, with bed nets, and those are bed nets that are treated with insecticide, and that means that when a mosquito lands on them, the mosquito dies. If you put enough of these out, if you cover like 80-90% of all beds in this village, enough mosquitoes die that you fix the problem. That is it. You create a mosquito-free zone that mosquitoes cannot penetrate, because a mosquito can only ever fly about 5 kilometers in its lifetime. So if you put enough of these things out, enough of mosquitoes die, and that's it. You've interrupted the malaria vector, the transmission mechanism, and it is fixed. And essentially, we know that this works because that using nets and using insecticide, using DDT, in fact, is how we fixed malaria in half the world already. If you go back a century, every single country in the world had malaria. You know, not a lot of people remember that. America had malaria till the 50s, Europe until the 60s and 70s. You know, there was a malaria in the Arctic and the Antarctic. This is something that malaria, in fact, predates man by you know, hundreds of millions of years. It's almost original disease. But this is something that we stopped in half the countries on Earth. And we did that using very simple techniques. And so for Ray and for the business guys that he kind of gathered around him, this became something fairly easy, it seemed, on paper, and it was a matter of implementing it on the ground. And actually, implementation, if you think about it, you know, the big successful multinational businesses, they're all about implementation in difficult environments. They're about drilling oil 100 miles offshore, 2 miles deep. They're about mining, you know, 100 miles into a jungle in, say, Gabon or Equatorial Guinea. These are people who are skilled and who have built fortunes by working in different environments. And so, in a sense, it's a natural fit for business and business people.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, "How can any attempt to deal with this scourge provide anything but short-term relief if the local political reality is always chaos? Without serious infrastructure projects that can eradicate the breeding potential for these mosquitoes, any successful approaches can only last a short time."
Well, that's a good point. I mean, political leadership is a vital component. It's very difficult to get much meaningful work done on health or anything else without political leadership. And, the standout example of that in Africa, that's also, you know, a real problem for malaria, is Congo. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is basically no political leadership. There is a president, there is a government, sort of nominally, but I mean, in reality, they have almost no control over what is a giant country. And when it comes to malaria, is the second worst affected in the country in the world after Nigeria. So there you have to, if you don't have political leadership, you have to try and find other structures through which you're going to work. What Congo does have and has had for decades is very strong missionary networks, and these are typically sort of Belgian nuns and priests who, I mean, they're not on a 2 or 3 year rotation. They're out in the jungle for 30 or 40 years on little or no money. I mean, really, that's a very strong network. And secondly, they have a strong aid agency network because the government is, frankly, so useless. There is a continual sort of emergency situation in Congo, and a number of aid agencies have built up a fairly permanent and robust presence there. But you're right. I mean, because of the lack of government, Congo was the big challenge in this campaign. But amazingly, they got their bed nets out. They had to get something like 60 or 70 million nets out. I forget the precise figure. And I believe as of this month, the last nets are going out, which is a phenomenal achievement. I mean, if you think about it, Congo, I mean, it's not just government. Because there's no government, there's virtually no roads. I mean, the only thing that works in Congo is the giant river that runs through it. But that means if you're distributing a bed net, you've got to get it onto a barge maybe a month or 6 weeks up that river, taken off into the interior, maybe thousands of miles. But most of that is going to be, your bed net is going to be carried on foot. You know, it's extraordinary logistical exercise. But they managed it. They managed it.
Alex Perry.
And again, that's a real lesson. I mean, most people until this campaign thought that, you know, just wrote off Congo. Nobody attempted anything in Congo because everyone assumed it was impossible.
Alex Perry is my guest. He's Africa Bureau Chief for Time Magazine and author of the new book Lifeblood, How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Alex Perry. He is Bureau Chief of Africa for Time Magazine and author of the new book Lifeblood, How to Change the World One Dead Mosquito at a Time. You can be part of this conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. You learned through the course of this investigation, Alex, some discouraging things about the organized traditional aid community, which is among which is the fact that although they sincerely want to help, they have sort of come to see a crisis as a funding opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it's we have to qualify that. I mean, AIDS organizations, you know, I'm not an AIDS cynic. I mean, they are intending to help. Are generally staffed by good and capable and motivated people with all the right intentions. But yes, that is the basic dynamic of aid. A crisis occurs and aid agencies ask for funding to fix it. That's actually kind of how it should be, with two provisos. You know, if the crisis is real, and if the aid agencies actually fix it. And unfortunately, the world is, and Africa in particular, is littered with examples where one or two of those do not hold. I mean, the example I use in the book of a crisis not being real but being called by the aid agencies is the recent economic downturn in 2008 and 9, when the world basically plunged into recession. There was a siren call that went out, almost universal from every big NGO, saying that this was going to affect the poorest of the poor worst of all. You may remember this. Mm-hmm. The number went round, 100 million people are going to be pushed into poverty. And those people are going to be the poorest of the poor. This was, you know, and this was for a journalist, this was quite a compelling story, because not only was this sort of, you know, fairly grim and dramatic, but the poorest of the poor were the ones who absolutely did not cause this crisis. They were the least to blame. So not only was this, so this was kind of doubly unfair. And in fact, from the IMF, there were warnings about coming civil strife, civil war even, mass migrations. You know, I mean, there was prediction of a phenomenal disaster. And none of this happened. Mm-hmm. None of it happened at all. In fact, Africa, which is home to the poorest of the poor, it has, you know, most of the poor countries in the world, did fine in the years 2008, 2009, and 2010.
Relatively speaking, fine.
In 2009, it still grew by 2%, but in 2008, it grew by about 5%, and by 2010, it was back to 5.6%. I mean, it's one of those things, those awkward facts that doesn't get out in discussions much about poverty relief and so on. But Africa is going through boom times at the moment and has been for about 5 or 6 years. So there was no extra poverty. There were no 100 million people pushed into poverty. In fact, you know, the more honest parts of the aid community admitted that they'd called a crisis that simply didn't exist. But amazingly, some of the organizations that knew exactly what that was going on, because they measure poverty and they measure economic growth in Africa, organizations like the World Bank and the IMF, kept on calling a crisis even after their own figures were showing that there was no crisis. And so you kind of have to conclude, well, they're doing this for their own purposes, which are raising money, refurbishing their budgets, and I don't know, perhaps elevating their own importance or the importance of their particular concerns. But what they are doing is being dishonest, in fact. And you see that time and again with aid, and it's fairly simple to work out why aid organizations or development organizations can get away with this, because they run their campaigns in the West, and what goes on and where the money goes and where the action is thousands of miles away. So there's a massive geographical disconnect. So I can stand up in London or New York or Tokyo and say, there's a crisis in country X. And you'll probably believe me, and I'll produce some really grim photographs taken by an eminent war photographer, you know, preferably in black and white. Mm. And I'll produce some very emotive language that'll basically ask you to forego a trivial amount of money and you can save a baby. But you don't know at all whether it's true that people are starving in, say, Niger, because you're not there and there's no chance of you ever getting there. And that allows, that lack of accountability has allowed for exaggeration and sometimes, you know, outright lies.
So how does Ray Chambers measure success?
He measures success by lives saved. Mm-hmm. You know, as I say, I mean, a lot of this is down to the kind of the PR and the marketing of aid agencies, who frankly, are a bit rogue in some cases. Most aid workers will admit to being kind of secretly ashamed of some of the campaigns that they see, although they see a higher purpose behind them. Now, Ray didn't do any fundraising for himself or any sort of self-promotion. He ran a tiny little office that was essentially trying to take on a kind of coordinating and managerial role, overseeing a load of other organizations that he didn't actually have any authority over, but he, you know, he only had the authority of persuasion and perhaps the authority that came with his office at the UN. He would measure things by life saved. It was all about number of children's lives he could save, and that actually is probably the most frustrating thing for him, because malaria statistics and statistics on number of children saved from a country as from a continent as big as Africa, and from countries where statistical information gathering is not strong, this can take years to come in. And so he set himself a deadline of the end of last year to distribute a bed net to everyone in the world that needed one. And when that deadline passed, he couldn't then turn around on January the 1st and say, I've saved X million lives, because the stats actually won't be in for about another year or two. Mm. And surprisingly to me, actually, he was that sort of rigorous with himself that he didn't sort of attempt an approximation. But I did. I phoned a scientist that I knew who'd been working in malaria for 20 years, and I sort of said to him, look, you know, this great effort, we've got to be able to say approximately, you've got to have some rough idea of how many people you might be saving and a kind of rough head count. And he did, actually. It didn't take very long to work out that in 2.5 years, essentially, Ray Chambers and the malaria campaign had either saved or set in motion a program that would save 2.5 million kids.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Hi, Jim. Ray Chambers, he can see obvious possibilities that everyone says don't think about it, they're impossible. Then he can act on them in maybe simple and formidable ways, but he can get the results, can't he? And why can't more people be taught to think that way?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, Ray, you know, anybody who I spend a considerable amount of time with him, but I talk, you know, a constant sort of topic of discussion among Ray's staff is Ray. What is it about Ray that gets people to do things and manages to persuade people that you know, he has a sort of an ability that other people don't have? And to be honest, the reason why it's a topic of discussion is because no one's ever really come up with a good answer. It's something to do with the fact that his voice, he sounds a bit like Clint Eastwood. You don't say no to someone who sounds like that. He doesn't smile or laugh much, and he has a sort of presence, and he speaks quite slowly. But there's, I don't know what it is. He just seems to, you know, for him, he has an ability to never really see a problem as insurmountable. And I suppose some of it comes from, you know, having had enormous success in the business world and having made gigantic quantities of money fairly easily, you begin to think, I suppose, that the world is full of possibilities, that not much is impossible, or that many problems can be addressed if only you put the effort in. Whereas I suppose most of us think, well, you know, perhaps fixing malaria on the planet is slightly beyond my reach.
Hmm.
You know, so he's a kind of outlier. He's a guy that will go, well, no, let's break this down. Let's see, you know, what would be the first part of a campaign? What would be the second? What would we need? What kind of resources? What kind of political capital? And so on. You know, you break it down into components until it becomes kind of manageable. And that's what he did. The malaria campaign goes on. I mean, it's in three parts, and the deadline of the end of last year was just the end of the first part. The next bit comes up in 2015. Then they, having distributed a bed net to everyone in the world who needs one, the next part is making sure that nobody actually dies of malaria, and that's 2015. The third part, which will probably take a couple more decades and probably need a vaccine, is simply eradicating malaria from the planet.
Can you talk a little bit about this? And we don't have too much time left in the hour, but it is a sort of a complicating factor. The reality that there is an industry now in organic farming taking place in sub-Saharan Africa, and that has complicated efforts in some places to use insecticides against mosquitoes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a classic example of something that sounds a brilliant idea in the West and involves all sorts of complications if you don't ask the locals.
Mm-hmm.
So Africa has a real deficit in pesticides and insecticides. You know, most stuff is grown in Africa organically anyway. That's seems to be an automatic fit with the rising demand for organic food in the West. And so the organic industry has moved in, you know, big time into Africa and farmland. And, you know, Africa also has a lot of land and you know, wonderful climate and rich soil. It's great farmland. This is not compatible, however, with, say, a malaria program which uses DDT or other pesticides and insecticides. You have, because, you know, for organic certification, there are a number of fairly strict standards you have to meet, one of which is not being next to a village, say, that's been spraying itself with insecticides every day. So the organic farming industry, which is a very benign sounding and progressive and hopeful looking industry for Africa, comes right up against Africa's health concerns. And in fact, in Uganda and in Apach, where I went, the most malarious town on earth, they'd had a very successful anti-malaria campaign that had halved the cases of malaria. And this in a town where 5,000 people are getting sick every week. They'd halved that and halved the number of deaths using nets and DDT for 3 months. And then there'd been a court injunction, and they'd been stopped from any more spraying. And the court injunction was brought by the Association of Organic Farms in Uganda, who said, if you keep using this chemical, we're not going to be able to sell our beans to Walmart. And particularly organic cotton is the major export from Uganda, and Walmart is the big buyer of that. All their cotton is organic. So, yes, you have this horrible situation where you know, out of good intentions on all sides, African babies are dying so that Western babies can wear organic. Really, that's as bleak as it gets. And as I say, I mean, this is entirely done with good intentions all sides, but it is done with ignorance of the situation on the ground. You know, and if it's a, you know, the golden rule that becomes clearer and clearer and became clearer and clearer to me when I was reporting this book is, if you're going to do something, if you're going to intervene in someone else's country, ask them what they want. You know, before you do anything, don't imagine you have the solution. Ask them what they want. Ask them what they need. Ask them how their country works. And then you'll have a better chance of getting it right.
Journalist Alex Perry is chief of Time Magazine's Africa Bureau. His new book is called Lifeblood: How to Change the World One Mosquito at a Time. Alex, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.